I'm going to call this a meeting of the House Early Childhood and Family Supports Committee to order for Thursday, March 16th. Colleagues, just a reminder, Friday, April 7th is the deadline to schedule work sessions for first calendar measures. And so we're going to, again, you'll see all of them as we're putting them on there, that possible work sessions. But if there's another one that comes in late, where I know we're still working on a couple pieces of the legislation, we just have to make sure we get them scheduled. And then the work session has to occur before April 18th in order for the measure to move. Bills in the committee that are not scheduled for work session by this deadline cannot receive further action. The deadlines don't apply to revenue rules and the joint committee. So in some cases, as some of you know that have been here, sometimes we just move it to one of those committees to keep it alive until we do something. But we'll try to get our business done on those schedules. So I'm going to open an informational hearing on trauma-informed care. And Representative Huffman, would you like to make a few comments before we start?
No, sir. I don't want to take away from their time. I just want to welcome the folks today and appreciate them coming. And it's going to be good information.
Great. Thank you very much. So our first panel is Claire, Molly, and Mandy. They're right up front here, ready to go. Thank you. And just introduce yourself before you speak for the record, please.
So I'm going to get started. You have a PowerPoint, right?
Okay.
Access to it.
It's going all over the place. I don't know what
yes,
you did.
But. This is a great presentation. Nicely done.
Yes.
It's still there.
There you go.
Thank you.
I can set it up for a moment.
Oh, perfect. Am I clicking through it, though?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. My control issues.
We don't want to make this too easy to start.
So, hello, my name is Mandy Davis, and I am the director of Trauma Informed Oregon. We are housed at Portland State University at the Regional Research Institute School of Social Work, and we're funded by Oregon Health Authority primarily. And so, thank you, chair and co chairs, and the committee for letting us have a moment to kind of chat with you today. I'm going to try to do two things at once here. So I'm actually going to start and try to set the stage for you about trauma-informed care prior to the other panels you'll be talking about. So what I want to do is talk a little bit about what trauma-informed care is, what it's not. I'm going to give you kind of rapid fire on the science behind it and kind of the foundational knowledge that supports that work. And then I'll be able to turn it over to what's going on in Oregon, how trauma-informed Oregon is approaching this, and then let you be able to hear from folks who are actually doing the work. I have to put a disclaimer in that I'm used to doing this in like 3, 6, 8 hour blocks. So bear with me, 18 minutes, I'm gonna make this work. But it's gonna be really fast and it's not gonna honor the complexity of the issue. So do take questions, I'm happy later. You can email me and kind of be a part of that any way you need to. So I'm gonna jump right in with the science of kind of trauma-informed care. And I'm doing that because, and it's a little bit of a reverse way to do it, but I think the important message about the science, because we won't have time to go completely into it, but it's important that you know this isn't just a feel-good kind of methodology or model. This is really grounded in some new information, and that really does two different things. It was new science that we didn't have before that gave us new information or validated what we've been seeing in practice. And so that's kind of really what's behind that. So I'm going to move through that kind of first. So the first thing is, I think we have to set the stage of what is trauma. And the reason we do is because that word itself means different things in different industries. And so it's important for we define that. It also does not translate well across language. So it's always really important that we start with understanding that. So as I'm talking about the word trauma today, I'm talking about the trauma can be a single incident, event. But for most of the folks we work with, we're talking about trauma that happens kind of over time, multiple events over time, prolonged, complex trauma. We often talk about trauma defined at trauma-informed Oregon through this SAMHSA, which is a Substance Abuse Mental Health Service Administration definition, that it's an event. It's also your experience to that event, and it's the effect that event had on your life and your well-being. And on that can be on an individual, family, or community. So it's important for us to note that we're talking about abuses, we're talking about violence, tragic death, but we're also talking about experiences of homelessness, poverty, racism, systemic oppression, and et cetera. So we really want to kind of broaden what our kind of historical definition of trauma has been as I move forward. So another kind of set of terms to think about when we talk about trauma is stress. And I bring this one up particularly because you're going to hear me today talk about complex trauma, adversity, and toxic stress all together. And the reason this is important is that stress we know is good. Stress is important for our development. Then we have this other level called tolerable stress, which can change the brain architecture. It's that big, but it's buffered. by a supportive relationship. And then we have this thing called toxic stress, which is prolonged and not buffered. And the reason I think it's important for me to talk about that briefly, and the reason I use those interchangeably, is that toxic stress has the same impact on the body, mind, and functioning as trauma does. And for workforce, which we're going to talk a lot about in trauma-informed care, they're often experiencing toxic stress. So the word trauma may not fit for them, but toxic stress does. So I want to kind of set that stage. All right, so I'm going to then talk about everything you need to know about neurobiology of trauma. So when we talk about the kind of science and educational foundation to the trauma-informed care movement, we often talk about NEAR science. And it's kind of a new acronym. We like acronyms. Your brain likes acronyms. It remembers them better. But it's important because it really is a better picture of what's going on. So NEAR science is neurobiology. E is epigenetics. A is adverse childhood experience. And R is resilience. And I'm going to kind of go through those in a small way to kind of understand what it's about. So neurobiology is the information, the knowledge that we want. And when we say knowledge, we want people to know in the trauma-informed care movement. We want everybody to know a foundational knowledge. So we're going to train custodial staff. We're going to train folks who, you know, serve food, who do bus driving. So all of this knowledge at a base level, everyone gets, every citizen, et cetera. So neurobiology gives us the information about how toxic stress impacts our brain's functioning and development, so our ability to remember, to process. A tiny example is on the board from Dan Siegel's work about the hand-brain model, the idea that we flip our lid when we have a real or perceived threat, and that when you flip your lid, you lose the kind of your prefrontal cortex capabilities, which is your rational thought, your ability to compromise, your forward thinking, your ability to engage in verbal processing, because you're in what's called survival mode. And what's important, the reason I bring up that little piece is that we spend a lot of time with just this information with agencies. So students are learning this in school, so they can be my PFC is offline, right? Because they're going to make it a cool acronym. And we're going to talk about when someone's kind of PFC is offline, they're not in a great way to engage with you. So we work with organizations to understand neurobiology so they understand the behavior in front of them, but also the workforce who has their lid flipped also, right? And so then how do we engage when those things are happening? So in trauma-informed care, we're really paying attention to how the neurobiology impacts our ability to engage and also to provide services in the best way, an efficient, effective way. The next set of data is epigenetics. And I am not a geneticist. I am a social worker in all levels. So I'll tell you as much as I can about it. But it's an important body of research and knowledge we want to incorporate into the trauma-informed care movement. And it's the information that helps us understand how the impact of toxic stress, adversity, and trauma gets transmitted across generations and genetic code. And it gives us a way to talk about generational trauma and collective trauma, especially with populations who have experienced systemic oppression time after time. So this is the kind of take-home message of epigenetics, is you're not what you eat, you're what your grandparents ate. Okay, so that's my way of kind of remembering how to think about that. The third piece of knowledge base is the adverse childhood experience study. You're going to hear more about this around the data about this later in your other panels, so I'm not going to kind of tell you the data, but I'm going to give you the picture of it. So ACEs is important because it's the study that has motivated many systems to get involved in trauma-informed care, especially healthcare. And what the ACE study did for us is it linked scientifically adversity in childhood to adult health outcomes. So it linked adversity in childhood, things like child abuse, but also homelessness, poverty, divorce. It linked it to things like COPD, stroke, heart disease, diabetes. And so the healthcare industry was able to kind of reframe how they were looking at that. So And this is probably hard to see, but the pyramid on the left is the original ACE study pyramid. The one on the right I actually prefer, and it was done out of a youth-led organization in California called RISE. And RISE took a bunch of, they studied it with youth and with parents and with providers, and they were like, it's not complete. So they made a new pyramid, which I really appreciate, which I think speaks to social determinants of health. And so what it starts with at the bottom is historical trauma, and then it moves from historical trauma into social location, so what you have access to. And then they change things like health risk to coping and et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's a better description of the whole picture of trauma-informed care and of the adverse childhood experience study. All right, and again, you know, you're going to hear some really great data about what ACEs look like in Oregon later, so that'll kind of frame that up. The last piece of research, kind of body of knowledge that we want to pay attention to is resiliency. And I really think we've actually neglected the body of knowledge of resiliency in some of our models. And definitely early childhood has this knowledge base that we want to pull in things like healthcare and other systems as we're doing the work. Resiliency, the reason it's so important to trauma-informed care is that it provides us the buffering variables. What is it that's going to either prevent, reverse, or heal adversity and toxic stress? So we're going to look at organizations and communities and ask, you know, do you have moments for reflection? How are you supporting connectiveness? We're going to ask, what about culture can be healing and that you're supporting in your kind of communities and your work around that? So what are you doing to build resilient models? There's a lot of work going on right now kind of nationally about kind of community resilience to respond to tragic disasters. So we're talking about that in a different way, which is kind of nice. All right. So that's the science of trauma-informed care. So now what I want to do is talk about what is trauma-informed care. And this is a really important conversation because it often is confused about what it is and what it's not. So trauma-informed care, we use the definition from SAMHSA, which says that a program organization or a program system or organization is trauma-informed if they do four things. Realize the widespread impact of trauma, recognize signs and symptoms, not just in clients and families, but also in staff. That's really important because that's new. It's a new variable in a lot of our models. Responds by fully integrating, and you'll notice, into policies and procedures, and then actively resist re-traumatization. So it's really important, if I'm able to do anything today, is to remind us all that trauma-informed care is about the big system. It's about how we do things. It's not about necessarily the direct service. That's a piece of it, but it's about how we do things. And that it's really about how we're going to change policies and procedures and to kind of move that forward. One of the biggest kind of confusions around trauma-informed care is the difference in trauma-specific and trauma-informed. Really important. Trauma-specific is an intervention that's been developed and tested and is meant to decrease symptomologies of trauma or to promote post-trauma growth in individuals, families, or groups. It usually comes with an acronym. You're going to hear about some of those today. Parent-child interaction therapy, collaborative problem-solving, motivational interviewing, eye motor desensitization reprocessing. So these are interventions. Trauma-informed care is how you function in your system. So what do your intake forms look like? What does your physical environment look like? How do you create a space? And I like to think that trauma-informed care is about creating a space where the whole brain can be engaged to the best of its ability for both staff and for families, the accessing service. So we believe in trauma-informed organ land that everyone should be trauma-informed. Not everyone does trauma-specific service. That's going to be dependent on your role in the community and space. All right, I am going to talk for a second about kind of why it's so important and really just these three bullets of that trauma differentially affects those who are more vulnerable. That's just an important message we have to keep saying because trauma can happen to everyone and does happen to everyone. But if you are vulnerable to get access to support and services that are kind of helpful and healing, it's going to make a difference. We also talk a lot about trauma impacts how people approach our service, and it's our service systems that have often been re-traumatizing. Mm. So if someone's coming into a school and has had bad experiences in school, they're not going to come to school, right? And so really talking about what's the system perspective of that, which is what we're mostly focused on. What trauma-informed care does not mean, which is always important for me to say because people will kind of need to hear this, is it doesn't mean permitting or excusing unacceptable behavior. Compassion and accountability is part of being trauma-informed. It doesn't mean just being nice. Okay, it's about really looking at this data and this research and doing our programs differently. It's about being direct and informative. It doesn't mean focusing on the negative. You can do trauma-informed care, entire program, and not use the word trauma. We want to build skills. We want to move forward. We want to empower. But we want to do it knowing something about kind of the impact of trauma. And it doesn't just mean training. Training's great, but we need people to have workforce wellness policies. We're looking at HR changes. We're looking at your physical environment changes. So really seeing the big picture of that. So what I want to do kind of in the last little piece here is talk about what's going on in Oregon. So what you really want to know is that there's a ton of stuff going in Oregon that we are a state to be really proud of and what we're doing around trauma-informed care. We are nationally looked at about what we're doing around trauma-informed care. It is a really new movement. It's not new practices, but it's a new movement. And we're kind of at the top of that. And what we're really known for is the state support of it, the support of trauma-informed Oregon, the policies that are coming out of that. So, this is a little bit of some history of this, is that the Children's System Advisory Council wrote a white paper in 2012 about the importance of trauma. OHA used that information to develop a policy in July 2014, trauma-informed care policy. And then Trauma-Informed Oregon was founded in 2014 with funding from Oregon Health Authority. The two things I want to point out about this information is, one, pretty new stuff. And the rapid, you know, the kind of response people want out of this and what people need is just constantly growing. So really new, and we're learning as we're going. I also really want to acknowledge two things. A lot of people, and especially the folks you'll hear from today, have been doing this work before 2012 and 2014. So we want to make sure we're listening and learning, and that's kind of my job, is to go around and hear what's already been done. We also want to say that anybody who's doing culturally specific programming or working with populations who have experienced oppression have been doing trauma-informed care before we called it trauma-informed care. So we have this name now, but we want to be really careful that we're honoring what's been out there. Now, to kind of wrap up the Oregon stuff, I want to kind of give you this framework. And this is Trauma-Informed Oregon's framework about how we kind of look at what we're supposed to be doing. And we're statewide, so we're trying to kind of meet the need across the state. There are really four areas we focus on. A big area of our time has been in training and education. So you'll see up here that in the last 6 months, we trained about 1,500 early childhood educators of some sort. Since 2016, we've trained about 4,800 people. You'll see on the right the different systems represented in that training. What's been really fun for me, who've been working in violence for a while, but trauma-informed care is bringing everybody to the table together in a way that I haven't experienced before. So we have environmental health, we have early Head Start, we have, you know, corrections and detention, and so all, and citizens, faith communities kind of coming around the table to talk about this issue. So training is constantly a need. We are at Trauma-Informed Oregon working on building training capacity through online training modules, through train the trainers, or kind of what we're trying to focus on, so that we can get training across the state. So training and education. We also do centralized resources community building. This is the fun part. I mean, it's all fun. But what I really like is that we get to go around the state, and we usually offer free training, but then have some community forum. What are you doing? What do you need? And so we get to talk to people about what that looks like. On the left, you'll see the forums we've already done. And then starting, I think, in 2 weeks, I'm headed out to Ontario, Canyon City, Corvallis, and Newport to have conversations with those groups. And those are community events. We invite everyone to come to the table for those. So we spend time there. And then we spend time, implementation and accountability is where I'm hoping to move more into. So Trauma-Informed Oregon, in order to help agencies you know, basically like, okay, we got this, we're on board, but how do I know I'm trauma-informed? So we developed a standards of practice to be trauma-informed. We also have that modified for primary care and also for education. So working to kind of do some cross-system work around that. So we're spending a lot of time with people rolling those standards out to give them a way to define trauma-informed care and show what they're doing really well, and hopefully we can pull those and start to learn across the state about what's happening. We are just starting to get into research around outcomes. So I mean, it's such a new movement, we're not there yet. There are some outcomes, and we'll look at some in a minute, but that's where we're trying to put some energy around that work. Policy investment is another place we spend our time, so listening to what's going on around the entire state and coming back and letting people know, here's what's happening, here's some great collaboratives or coalitions that are kind of happening and connecting the dots to that stuff. One of the things I do want to point out we're doing a lot of, because I think it's important as our work moves forward in trauma-informed care, is what I'm calling initiative mapping, that we're really trying to pay attention to. If you are doing, or if you're building a resilient school and community, you're probably doing trauma-informed care. So my job is how to map that together, right? If you're doing equity work, you're probably doing trauma-informed care. If you're doing restorative justice, and so how do we map those so, again, that we're more efficient and effective? It's not another new thing to add to the burden of staff. And so we're really trying to make sure we get that message out. So let's see, I will wrap up just in summary. I think what I want to say is the practices on the left, just to give you a little bit of an idea that what trauma-informed care looks like is really different in the industry and the area. So what trauma-informed care looks like for law enforcement is different than what it looks like in early childhood. And we really leave it up to folks to define that. Here's what we, you know, you need to have a workforce wellness program. What does that look like for you? It's going to be up to you about that. And that's important because I think it's allowing it to actually move forward, because there's no manual to trauma-informed care. You learn by doing it. It's a process. It's a culture change. So lots of different practices from training. And again, we ask that all people get trained. Peer support, workforce wellness is a big focus right now. So we have grants coming into Oregon looking at workforce wellness for educators, because if we can't keep staff on the job, all of those great practices we know work aren't going to work. And so it's a big focus of trauma-informed care is retention and workforce wellness. You'll see the outcomes we think we're going to see. Some of them we're starting to see, but again, we're not there yet. But we think we're going to see is a lot around improved workforce wellness. So retention, people staying on the job in a healthy way. I want to make that caveat, not just staying on the job. You know, reduced burnout, use of vacation days. We'll see better cross-system integration, and that's already happening. I mean, yesterday there was a meeting with, you know, educators and public health, and how do we merge these two things together around trauma and adversity and reducing that. And then third, increased engagement. I really like to say trauma-informed care is an engagement tool. We have some great practices for families and individuals, but if we can't get people in the door to receive those practices, they're not being utilized. So we think people will show up and they'll stay in services for a longer amount of time, both staff and then those we're trying to engage. So I'm going to stop. That's pretty good. And I want to turn it over, because what I'm really excited about is that because I was trying to set the stage of what trauma-informed care is, and now you get to hear from folks who are actually kind of doing it in the real world, maybe, or out in the community.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Hello, my name is Claire Rannett. I'm the project director for the Mobilizing Action for Resilient Communities grant in the Columbia River Gorge through the Columbia Gorge Health Council. Thank you, Chair Representative Lively, co-chairs Representative Hackenpeluso, and members of the committee for hearing us today. So things are done a little differently in the Columbia River Gorge, whether we're strapping ourselves to kites to harness wind, raising the sails for a Wednesday evening race, treading down a trail in our faithful hikers, or strapping boards to our feet to fly through the powder down a mountain. We're always looking for the right tools and good conditions to reach our goals. In 2011, a small group of Columbia River Gorge leaders gathered for an event, as they had many times before, and realized they were running around the same old hamster wheel. They could rally around the shared goal of better outcomes for struggling kids and families, but that's usually where the collaboration stopped and the finger pointing started. If only the school districts could create smaller classrooms, kids wouldn't act out as much. If only DHS could send the community mental health provider the correct referral. If only the community mental health provider could shorten wait times for child psychiatrists. If only, and on and on. Each of the organizations was trying to reach the shared goal, but were they given the right tools and the good conditions? One of the leaders spoke out and shared an observation, one that would be the spark to start a culture shift in the Columbia River Gorge community. And the observation was this: many of the characteristics expressed by community organizations were the same symptoms expressed by people that have experienced trauma. Symptoms of organizations that have experienced trauma include things like communication breakdown, repetitive failures, powerless staff and clients, lack of conflict resolution, increased aggression, and poor emotional management. Just as individual people experience trauma, so do organizations, systems made up of people. Just as stressors can exceed an individual's ability to cope, so too can stressors exceed an organization's ability to cope. This process leads to symptoms in the organization and the people that make up the organization. And the people that make up an organization are not only staff, but also those clients who seek services. And the people that make up organizations also make up our communities. So where does that leave us? The school district might not have the budget to create smaller classrooms, but they might be able to adjust environments so all kids feel safer physically, emotionally, and psychologically. DHS could sit down with the community mental health provider and learn more about the referral process. The community mental health provider could communicate about the resource strain in psychiatry and ways to access supplemental services as a bridge during wait periods. Solutions such as these are all examples of trauma-informed care practices in action. Trauma-informed care practices help to build organizations that are better prepared to handle stressors, because stressors will always exist. There is still cross-organizational conflict between organizations in the Columbia River Gorge, but you won't find much finger-pointing anymore. They've hopped off the old hamster wheel. Through trauma-informed care practices, a framework of shared language and shared understanding has been built. When conflict arises now, the first thought is not what's wrong, it's what's happened. Organizations look to see how they can step in to provide support and collaborative problem solving. So again, where does that leave us? In October 2015, the Columbia River Gorge community was awarded the Mobilizing Action for Resilient Communities grant by the Health Federation of Philadelphia, with support from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the California Endowment. This cross-county collaboration is possible due to the existence of the Columbia Gorge Health Council, created as a result of coordinated care organization legislation and the community drive to do things a little differently. The Columbia Gorge Health Council serves as a multi-county sector in the Columbia River Gorge area, focusing on both individual and social determinants of health, an organization and community. The MARC grant funds community trauma-informed care practices work through October 2017 in Oregon counties of Hood River, Sherman, and Wasco. Through the grant, Free community trainings and learning collaboratives are offered. Organizations supported and coached towards trauma-informed care practices implementation. New organizations and workforce sectors engaged in what it means to be trauma-informed, and knowledge more widely spread throughout the community. Mark Grant's staff also supported the training of over 100 staff members at Mid-Columbia Children's Council, the Head Start and Early Head Start providers in the Columbia River Gorge. Providing staff at all levels, administrative, maintenance, and teaching, with shared knowledge and tools to create a healthier culture in which staff work and children and families receive services. The Mark Grant is the third iteration of funding in the area focused on creating a more trauma-informed community. This time around, special focus has been given to the physical, medical, and justice sectors with the goal of increased knowledge and engagement. In October 2016, the grant funded a trauma-informed and resiliency summit, made free to the community, and saw 214 people attend. Out of those 2 days, there are many stories to be shared of paths changed. In May 2017, we will be hosting a trauma-informed care practices event focused on those individuals working in the justice system. I wonder how many stories of changed paths will come out of that event, simply by spreading the word and knowledge and providing tools. The justice system fills a needed and noble role, just as many of the other social services offered in different communities. We have created these systems and organizations for people to do good and needed work, to support communities to be healthy and whole. So I leave you with this thought. Are we allowing those organizations the freedom to use the right tools and to create good conditions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair and honored members of the committee. My name is Molly Rogers, and I am the director of the Department of Youth Services in Wasco County. And I have to, just listening today and thinking about my 21 years tenure of being in the role of juvenile justice, trauma-informed work and really the impacts of the kind of elements of trauma-informed communities has been the biggest change that I have seen and the most hope that I have been offered for working in the juvenile justice field. It just feels better. It's not easy. And it does not remove accountability. It's just the right way to do. My testimony today is to highlight the impact of trauma-informed practices in the social service systems in Wasco County and how the changed experiences has changed in how we provide our services to citizens. As you've heard from Claire, we started our journey to find a better way to provide services back in 2011, about the same time we were having the discussion on the state level. We were not working together in Wasco County, even though we all had the same goal. In fact, if you lined up all of our vision and mission statements on the wall, the words wellness, safety, engagement were all there. Even with our good intentions, we did not have the tools to actually work together to move the dials of these critical elements that our families and our community expected us to do. A core management team was developed. This is probably the most unique thing that had happened for Wasco County. We all worked together, but we really learned together. So it was the executive director of our community mental health organization, the superintendent of the largest school district in Wasco County, the district manager of the State Department of Human Services, and myself. In the early part of the core management team, the administrator of the Oregon or of the Wasco County Commission on Children and Families, and the chief of police of the Dalles was on the core management team. He's since retired, but the new chief is pretty good too. But Chief Waterbury was a dandy to have there.
Do I need to talk to Pat?
I know.
That's right. Bring him along.
Actually, no. He's a little softer than Chief Waterbury, but yeah. State police. We made work on him a little bit. Once this group got together and talked, but when we talked about safety, we talked about cameras in a school. And that's an element of safety. That's not the element of safety. And so we quickly changed our conversation. And we actually chose very methodically, we chose the sanctuary model out of Andrus in Yonkers, New York. And we sent a team back to the 5-day training to have that common experience so that when they came back, they were able to infuse it into our community. And that was a really key for us. And we've continued our relationship with the sanctuary model, and they come out and train. And Claire has also been to the training, and so she provides two-day trainings every quarter that are free to our community. So we looked at the interactions and these cameras and realized we were way too late in the ballgame. So we started to move upriver. And I want to share a really specific example of what changed. So I had the opportunity to manage both probation and the prevention side. And our prevention specialist, Debbie Jones, came to me one day and said, I think we're doing drug and alcohol prevention wrong. And she said, I want to implement something for ages 0 to 6. And I said, okay, lay out the plan for me. So she shared with me that in order to teach kids the danger of drugs and alcohol in middle school was way too late. We needed to train child care providers, elementary teachers, and other early childhood professionals how to implement an emotional literacy plan. And we chose Pocket Full of Feelings. So I want to take a second and think about this. Our drug and alcohol prevention program now moved to early childhood emotional literacy. Because what we believe is that if children have the ability to be emotionally safe and be able to articulate their feelings and make a connection with a caring adult, and that they have the words and the language, that we believe that's how we'll change the dial on drug and alcohol use in the future. This has blossomed into what we have now are called boot camps. So they're 2-hour boot camps for parents of young children, and it really is teaching them on how to manage and respond to their children's emotional needs. This also opens the door for those parents to come back and access services later. And we're now working on a emotional literacy parenting program for toddlers to teens. And so we'll have a continuum of services based on this model in Wasco County. In our community, the heroes that work with children and families have embraced the trauma-informed approach, and I believe they've been waiting for us as decision makers to catch up. Claire mentioned the training of 214 professionals. The key difference in the change that we've had in Wasco County is that we train together. I train with an EMT. I did not know how impactful firefighters and emergency responders are in families' lives. They're incredible. We train with them, we train with educators, we train with the health department, we train with early childhood and adult corrections. And that's been the difference for us. For a long time, our professional organizations have trained in our disciplines. It's different as we train with the community. And as I think about policy and what you guys can do in the ask is really encouraging and supporting as state agencies engage with us at the local level. I know that state trainings are important. I understand the value behind why you train as a state, but also encouraging them to do the local piece. As I move to close, I want to tell you how this has grown, not just within our social service world in Wasco County, but Wasco County itself. And I have a button on that says 100% love. And this often feels like an early childhood thing, but I would challenge that if you were to be in Wasco County and out and see the road workers, that they might also have a 100% love button on. Wasco County had found itself in toxic stress for several years, and we knew we needed to do something different. And so there's a long story that goes on to it that John can tell you, Representative Huffman can tell you. but we chose to get off of the trauma triangle as a county, and we realized that we had hunkered down and were being the victims. And we have chosen to implement an entire guide called 100% Love with 3 main values. And I'll leave you with those 3 main values as I leave today. The first are relationships are primary. And so in Wasco County, that's what we believe. The second is implement 100% Love. And this is law enforcement, by buying a couple of blankets for horses who need to be sheltered, by assisting somebody in putting a mailbox back up. And the last is doing the right thing when no one is looking. And so that is kind of where we've decided as our county culture to move to, and what all started with this kind of quick notion of we just need to do and ask what's happened instead of look at each other and say what's wrong with you. Thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you very much. Questions, comments by members? Representative Pinnegar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that presentation. I know how hard that was to do the science basis of this, because I've been through this many times. But thank you for laying the groundwork. Thank you, both of you, for your testimony and coming from so far away. And you are very fortunate to be represented by a representative who certainly embodies those three principles.
Yes.
I had a question about the child welfare system. And we're looking a lot at trauma-informed training and not specifically maybe a particular curriculum, but the debate is whether there should be a particular curriculum or whether it should just be a lens in all of the other trainings. And I know that they've been talking to PSU, so I'm assuming that you're at the heart of those conversations, Mandy. So I'm wondering if you can just talk a little bit about the trauma, what is needed in our child welfare for children, for families, for employees, for family certifiers, for case managers, for licensing people, just all across the board, if you can give me some highlights of what is needed.
I can take it or you can take it.
Go for it.
Chair Lively and Representative Kinney-Geyer, I look at an organization at the state level and ask what's happened. And Department of Human Services is definitely one that I've asked what's happened. And I think it's all of what you just said above. I think it's some very specific things. And there's some evidence-based ones to work with child welfare. I also think for our local DHS, it's giving them energy and credit to work with us at the local level, because that's really where child abuse happens, is locally. And so having the work across so it's not them doing it themselves, but that they're standing together in with juvenile justice, with mental health, and with the Department of Education. So there are some models out there. Again, we chose the sanctuary very specifically, and we have really enjoyed that. And a couple reasons why was the seven commitments and the shared language. I don't think that necessarily needs to be statewide. I think that there can be some flexibility in that, as long as I also think that the caseworkers for DHS need to be given and have the opportunity to recognize what they have been through. And that it's okay if you're working just from your amygdala as an organization for a while, if you're putting the things in place to move back to the frontal cortex. And so I think I'll let...
What's the resiliency piece?
Yeah, so thank you for the question. I mean, I think it's a big question of what's going to be the trick, and it's not going to be a curriculum. And so I think that's the important thing, is that there's curriculum we can put in core training, which mm-hmm. they're doing, right? But then it's getting it back out into the practice, into the coaching models. Like, where's the role play? Where's the coaching? And I actually am really interested, and people are starting to talk about this, is how do we get it into the foster parents, the community? I mean, I really think we're looking at community. I mean, I'm getting kind of big where I think we need to be training community. It's like in schools, we're talking about PTAs need to have the knowledge, right, mm. so that we all are engaging in that level. So I will not be able to give you a quick answer to how to infuse the knowledge. I think it's a multi-tiered approach, and I think we tend to go after a curriculum that goes straight to the caseworker, and then we don't include the supervisors, we don't include the leadership. Like, everyone's got to have that. And we started down that path several years ago where I was doing some of that, but it was per locale who said, I'm interested in this. And so it was kind of gurgling up, which was good. I mean, it gurgled up from the bottom up, but then it lost any kind of systemic support. So I think there's got to be that both, which is a lovely answer.
Well, just to follow up to say that we are trying to do a systemic approach, mm-hmm. and maybe Representative Peluso wants to add to this, but it's hard to know where to start. We have a limited budget. What is the most important priority to start? Because it's going to take a while, not just resources, but human power as well. You don't have that many people trained to go out and do this, and so
yeah,
it's hard to know where to start.
So I can speak a little bit too. I coach and I work with and I train DHS staff in our area, and it's learning a curriculum and completing a training is one thing, right? But really where the breakdown is when you go back to your organization, how do you then practice it? And that's really where people struggle. And so one of the best supports that I can provide to them is coaching and implementation support through that process once they've learned whatever the curriculum is or the knowledge is, but then it's how do I practice it daily? So having that support system in place for those organizations that are trying to build in that daily practice is something that they've really needed.
I appreciate what's in front of you, thinking through that. Yeah. I mean, because we're looking, I mean, that's kind of, we're doing the same thing. Can we do some online training models mixed with tele? Like, because I'm also trying to get to Burns in Ontario, and how do we get that information used? So is there some use of technology we can put in place there so people can see some of that? Or there's some films or role plays that we can, so people are competency-based learning, where we can kind of keep that going. So that's what we're trying to roll out, online competency-based learning, by the end of summer with the basics. And then how do we make some of those disciplines specific? One of the biggest, and corrections work, I think really the focus on training right now is on workforce regulation strategies. I mean, it's showing that in education, too, if we can teach literal regulation skills to the workforce, there's actually a pretty good outcome in what can then happen with the practices we already know. But if we can't keep ourselves regulated and able to kind of be in those crisis moments in a way that's healthier. So I'm looking at that, too, like, what is, because we don't really actually do that. We talk about it. But am I really going to teach you and train you, just like I do to fill out your case notes, to also keep yourself regulated in a moment that's challenging? So I'll keep you posted.
Senator Brock Smith.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And thank you for all your work. And we've met before.
Uh-oh.
I'm not
Polly,
sure.
Right?
Okay.
Juvenile, Wasco County?
Yes.
So former Curry County Commissioner.
Oh, yes.
Jonathan Trost is our juvenile director. We've discussed.
Did have a conversation.
Yes. Yeah, so, again, appreciate all your work. And part of, to go back to the DHS training, there's a bill, House Bill 2500, that I know Representative Kenny Geyer has been working on in her committee, and Representative Stark has been working on, but would require DHS caseworkers to go through more training and then have that training every 2 years with attorneys and judges and just a more strenuous curriculum to keep things a little better. And then secondly, just an update with Jay. He sent me an email update just yesterday where Curry County has the lowest rate among all counties with 15 or more referrals, 14.6% lowest in Curry County's documented history. So it's very exciting.
It is very exciting.
So,
Chair Lively, Representative Brock Smith, the one thing that I've heard is caseworkers. I will tell you the most important person in my office, so I'll go back to my office, who's trained in trauma-informed work is my receptionist. She is absolutely the consistent person in my office that sees everybody come through the door is her. And she approaches and thanks everybody for coming in. She is my heart of the trauma-informed implementation in my department's piece. The other part is, I'll leave it at that.
To the DHS lens as well, I've also provided one training to foster care parents. And that was very important for the ones that attended, was the feedback that I've got, because providing that emotional literacy and the ability to talk about feelings and to talk about emotional management and regulation in that role, and the difficulty and challenge of being a foster parent and the reward, and helping them to understand that we can build those skills into the children that they're helping as well, that they're parenting, was the feedback that was given. So a value for them as well in learning about trauma-informed care.
Representative Huffman.
If I could close it out, Mr. Chair, because I think we're out of time.
You wouldn't open it,
right?
Okay.
Is that right? I'm the closer. So, you know, I've long had a vision of healthy community concept for the Dalles and the greater the Dalles region. And so the more training I've had here, I see that this is really the foundational piece. And my hope is that while I'm here working, if the Dalles is chosen as one of the new Blue Zones program communities, that this will be, that you guys will be at the table, and this will be the kind of setting the foundation for all the healthy communities work through the Blue Zones program, so that all of that work will have a solid foundation of not what's wrong with you, but, you know, yeah, it's just so. it's all tied in together. And Representative Brock Smith, I was thinking as he was talking, you know, it's important that you know, police officers, you know, all of our law enforcement, all of our elected officials locally, because, you know, they can get into some interesting discussions. And it's important for all of them to have this kind of training.
First responders.
Yeah.
So besides the training, so my question is, how do you sustain? So I appreciate the training and getting people started, but given all the other that shoots at it at times, the negative and all this, so sustaining it long term, what's it take to do that?
Chair Lively, thank you for the question. And the piece is a commitment from your leadership. And then the second part, of which we currently have in our region, in our community, and we've been through four DHS, we're on our fourth DHS program manager since we started this. So it's outlived a person, I guess is my point there. And we're on our second chief of police. And when we get the opportunity to write it into policy, or like what Wasco County did and chose to make it a culture guide and put it in writing, those are the tools that are necessary to keep it moving forward. The first, I want to say the first year we implemented it was hard.
I wondered.
It has been some of the hardest work, because it's pretty quick and easy to go back to just what's wrong with you and to kind of get mad. It takes a lot more work to say what's happened and how can we do it together.
Great. Thank you.
Any other? Representative Bynum is thrilled that I had this training before the session.
But she
is. So that I'm not.
I think the whole legislative body needs this training.
I think that's probably a good idea.
Exactly. I have suggested it to the speaker that this, you know, because she asked about where could we take the next step of training, I suggested this. So.
That's a great idea.
If you could help support that, that'd be great.
I will back that up.
Thank you.
You just never know. I mean, especially as far as elected officials, as you mentioned, Representative, and first responders, if you will, because we could be, as we all know, at the post office or in the grocery store, and somebody comes up that has gone through a very tragic event. As the commissioner involved with juvenile department, I mean, you get the worst of the worst, and so I think you're right. We should have the training.
We should have it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, we're going to hear from Renee Brandon from the Southern Oregon Early Learning Services.
Good afternoon.
Welcome.
It's outside the room.
I guess I'm the panel of one.
Panel
right?
of one.
Okay.
You can switch back and forth among microphones, or just move to chair, whatever works.
Thank you, Chair Lively, members of the committee. I'm Renee Brandon, director of the Southern Oregon Early Learning Hub, serving Jackson and Josephine County. I know that several of my Early Learning Hub colleagues across the state have had the opportunity to share some of the good work that's been happening all over the state with the different early learning efforts. What I'm hoping to focus on today is to share what we are doing region-wide with trauma-informed care. And I think you might have heard about our three overarching goals that all the 16 hubs are responsible for aiming for. The first is a coordinated and aligned family-centered system. The second are families that are healthy, stable, and attached, so that we can have children that arrive at kindergarten prepared and supported for success. And so what I'm hoping to share with you today is our efforts on trauma-informed care. The way that each region focuses on those three goals is really dependent upon the strengths and the champions within the region. And we have some really exciting things happening in Southern Oregon. The first big strategy we have towards reaching our goals is focusing on region-wide training. I am a member of the Southern Oregon Success, which is our regional achievement collaborative, serving cradle to career. The Early Learning Hub is really focusing on that first segment of that cradle to career continuum. Mid-2016, we were really fortunate, we're fortunate to have former Representative Peter Buckley driving that effort, but we were able to bring some very well-respected researchers, including Robert Alda, who was the co-principal investigator for that adverse childhood experiences study, to our region as kind of a kickoff event. Hundreds of people came to this two-day seminar. The picture that you see there is really after the big presentation, coming together in pockets of the community to say, so now what? What are we going to do? We hear the research, we see the need, but what do we do about it? And so my responsibility as the Early Learning Hub director in my region is to coordinate that system. And so my call was to convene where I have my sphere of influence, which are the stakeholders, the sector stakeholders that are part of our system. And so, sorry, I'm looking at my notes here. So starting, I think, May 2016, 70 introductions to ACES trainings were held. Over 2,200 local partners and community members were trained. And just this last week, I think 14 new introduction to ACES trainers have been trained and ready to deploy in our region. I got an email from Peter Buckley last night. Didn't have time to update the slide, but he was sharing that just for 2013 alone, there have been 30 new trainings and over 1,200 additional folks trained. So there is definitely a groundswell happening in Southern Oregon. I jokingly say that in order to avoid an introduction to ACES training, you really need to be actively avoiding it because they're so prevalent and accessible in our region, which is really pretty amazing. The second strategy we're focusing on to become a trauma-informed region is really engaging, as I said, the sphere of influence in the early learning system. So we have a monthly meeting with sector partners for the Early Learning Agency Advisory Council. And I came to them after this training opportunity and asked them if they would be willing to become a community of practice toward working toward becoming trauma-informed. And so for the last 4 months, that's the work that we have been doing. We have been using Trauma-Informed Oregon's resources, and I'm pulling them up at each meeting to help partners to really see and access the resources that are available. So we're currently working through the standards of practice, looking at the training, an agency's levels of training. Is it just the administrators that are trained, or are the line staff also trained? Making sure that every layer of an organization receives that training. We're looking at, there are environmental scans where we can walk through and do a quick assessment of the lobby, of meeting rooms, just to find those small things that can really make a difference when we're looking at trauma-informed practices. We know that systems change is a slow process. One of my favorite quotes is, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And that's really the work that we're doing. So we know that what we're doing right now is just the down payment on the trauma-informed transition that we're needing to see in our community. But having these multi-sector partners engaged every month has been a really wonderful beginning to that. I put a little design there that really shows kind of the process that we're working through. So the first is training, and then partners committing, then reviewing policies and procedures, moving on to looking at the protective factors and resiliency that agencies can foster, which I'll talk about in a minute, so that end users are really supported in becoming more self-sufficient and more able to care for their families' needs. The third strategy I'm really excited about, we're just going to be launching this May, is giving the tangible skills. It's one thing to educate, it's another thing to have a call to action and a commitment, but then how do we do the work? And so we are fortunate enough through our Early Learning Hub to bring the Center for the Study of Social Policies, Strengthening Families, Protective Factors Framework training to our region, where we will have 20 trainers certified to roll out this implementation to our sector partners. And so the idea is that any of our partners who are working directly with families will be learning the same vocabulary. They will be focusing on empowering families the same way. And they will be focusing on the five protective factors to do that. And so the five protective factors include family or parental resilience, social connections, concrete supports in times of need, knowledge of parenting and child development, and then social emotional competence of children. This is an evidence-informed framework. It's not a canned model that you roll out. It really is a set of tools that we will support our service providers in implementing. So with the vision that we will have that foundational training and then the tools to really support families, whatever point in the system they happen to enter, we will be able to support them in that with that type of framework that they need for success. And so I really think that it is kind of the perfect storm in Southern Oregon, where we had enough of the community will, support, and interest to bring the trainings here, for enough of our community leaders to say, I want to sign up to be a trainer of trainers for my colleagues, to really then generate interest with all of the agencies that are taking part in this. And then being able to bring in national trainers to be able to deploy our local leaders to be able to provide the supports to those working with families. So we're really excited. We know that this is a new effort. Hoping we can come back again and share progress once we have some data to support our efforts. But we really, really grateful for Peter Buckley with Southern Oregon Success and a lot of the other thought leaders who have been really championing these efforts in Southern Oregon. We believe that it's going to really help to reach those overarching goals that every early learning hub is striving to achieve. And thank you for your time today.
Any questions?
Just a comment. To get on the record, I really owe Peter Buckley, because we had a conversation a year ago, and he was talking about his new work with trauma-informed care and the sanctuary model and ACEs, and he could see that I was there was nothing right registering back there. And so he explained a little bit about it, which prepared me mentally then for when I met Claire and we started talking. So the timing for me was just really perfect, and Peter was the one that first mentioned the terms to me and opened me up to be prepared for the relationship with Claire then. So,
other questions, comments? Renee, do you know if are other early learning hubs, there's 16, and I'm sure you talk amongst yourself, so are others starting to move in this direction?
I know that there is interest. I am not hearing of any that have kind of the groundswell that we have. Mm-hmm. And I think that Representative Huffman really defined it clearly. It's the timing. Yeah. The timing is salient. I was sharing with Lori Theodoro, who you'll hear from shortly, that, you know, those of us in the early childhood education have known about the ACEs study for like 2 decades. Mm. But there wasn't enough movement and interest outside of our little nucleus to gain the kind of traction. Mm. And so it really is, the timing is a beautiful thing. The hubs coming on within the last couple of years, the timing is just perfect for us to be able to be a part of this community-wide effort, sure. Knowing that we, again, are just one segment on that continuum, but a very significant segment. And we're really excited to have that opportunity.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anything else? Thanks a lot. So up next from the Oregon Health Authority, Kate Wilcox and Lori Theodora. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Chair Lively, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Kate Wilcox. I'm back again. And thank you for having me, Chair Lively, and members of the committee. I'm Lori Theodoro. I am the Early Childhood Mental Health Specialist with the Health Systems Division, Operations and Policy.
And I'm with the Public Health Division. Unfortunately, I don't have a poem for you today, but I have a PowerPoint.
Okay.
Yay. So I try to make every presentation a little bit different. So. We're going to share with you today what's happening in the Oregon Health Authority around trauma, toxic stress, and adverse childhood experiences. And I think this is going to build nicely on the presentations you heard before. I will start with a little story. We hired Trauma-Informed Oregon, and Mandy came for a workforce development training, all-day training for the maternal and child health section as well as adolescent health, and our partners who work in children and youth with special health needs. It just so happened that was the day after our election. And depending on, it didn't matter whether you were had a happy outcome or a sad outcome, it was a surprising outcome for everyone. And I couldn't have imagined a better day to spend together under the guidance of Mandy's expertise in walking us through how you deal with trauma and support each other through those kinds of experiences. So hats off to Mandy. So that's my little story. All right, so we're going to start with a little bit of the data and the framing again. This is just a pictorial that shows how really this whole, it's a multifaceted sort of arena that we're working in. So adversity and trauma can arise from different sources across the lifespan. So you have historical trauma that includes racism and childhood adverse childhood experiences, adverse peer and or school experiences when you get into the K-12, and then, of course, as an adult, we also experience adversity. And you pull all that together and you have multiple mental, physical, relational, and productivity problems, and that can be then intergenerationally transmitted. So the challenge is to help prevent that intergenerational transmission, and as a prevention, but also work with those who have had these experiences to keep our flipping our way. All right, so I'm going to share with you some data. One of our great national resources of data is the National Survey of Children's Health. They are moving on to an annual survey. It was done every other year. Some of this data looks old, but it's actually the newest that we have. If you look here, the green has, those states have significantly lower ACEs among their children. The red is the highest, and sadly, Oregon is in the red category. So on the other hand, there isn't a whole lot of green, which means that, you know, as a country, we have a whole lot of work to do in this area.
Before we move on from this, who's collecting the data and how is this being done?
There's an organization called CAMI, and it's the, oh gosh, I'm going to have to get the acronym for it. But it
Child Abuse Mental something?
Yeah.
That's the CAMI.
It used to be housed at OHSU. They've now moved to Johns Hopkins. Uh-huh. But Christy Bethel has been the PI on that survey during its whole inception and its implementation. And so this survey is done across the United States, across all different domains around child health. And it was done every other year, and now it's going to be happening every year. And they've added questions around ACEs starting about in 2011, which was the first year that they did that. All right, so when we dig down into this data and really look at breaking down the child portion of that, we can see that for children 0 to 5, Oregon tracks relative to the U.S. Closely, if not a little bit better than the U.S. So I still would argue that 12% having two or more adverse childhood experiences is not okay. But when we look at 6 to 11-year-olds, when we go to that two or more, we see that Oregon is significantly higher than the U.S. And so what that says is by the time kids enter the K-12 system, you know, they've had a lot of trauma and exposure. And so the opportunity for us is to actually intervene in that 0 to 5, and some would even argue preconception and prenatal period. Now, in Oregon, we're collecting information on our behavioral risk factors surveillance system. We do this every other year. We do the ACEs module in this. And so we have a couple of years of data that we can share with you. And this is a broad population-based survey of adults. So this is adults looking back on their own childhood experience. And what we see is that 44% of Oregonians have experienced two or more ACEs. And 22% have experienced four or more. So that's pretty staggering when you think about that nearly half have experienced that level of exposure. From the same information, and when we break it down across some of the domains, we see that more than a third have experienced emotional abuse, more than a third have experienced household substance abuse,
And nearly a third have had a parental separation or divorce as those factors that are most prevalent. But still, 15% experiencing sexual abuse or 24% physical abuse, I mean, those are also pretty staggering. If we look at it across the demographics, I think we start to see some suggestion of historical trauma. 37% of our Native American community have four or more ACEs. Likewise, almost a third of the Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander population have experienced four or more ACEs. Those who have been on Medicaid in the past 12 months, almost 35% have experienced four or more, and 28% of those with less than a high school education have experienced four or more. I think I want to caution us from always going to sort of the typical at-risk people, because one of the things about all of this is there's no immunity depending on your demographic. There are risk factors that make you more risk propensity for having an ACE, but I want to say that ACEs can happen across any demographic line. Now, this is an interesting pictorial, and I had to go back to my public health epi to get the definition of population attributable risk. But what this shows is you've got a series of conditions and lifelong health conditions around the outside. So risk for HIV, alcohol or heavy drinking, cardiovascular disease, cancer, divorce, separation, etc. These are some of the chronic conditions that we live with as adults. And when we look at the data and those who have those conditions, when we look at their ACE score, we see that the impact that ACEs has in contributing to experiences for those lifelong chronic conditions. For example, nearly 60% of those who are at high risk for HIV have experienced childhood events or adverse childhood events. I was talking about this with a colleague of mine earlier today, and she said, I'm surprised that alcohol and heavy drinking is only 21%. And I also think about, you know, the population that drinks is probably much greater than those that might be at risk for HIV. So you have just a much greater denominator within that. But what it does say, if you just look at the picture, and we call it the ink blots picture, really the impact and the pervasivity of ACEs in our society.
And so this is a one-time only, or is this something ongoing that we could see, that you'd be able to see the shifts in the...
Chair Levy, that's a good question. And I can go back and ask. Laura Porter works out of the University of Washington, I believe. And I don't know whether she did this at one time or is doing it with all of her data.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So going back to our BRFSS data here in Oregon, we are still working on this analysis, but I wanted to share with you some preliminary information, and we're going to be coming out with a report hopefully later this year that dives into this a little bit more. But if you can see, within each of these domains, the dark blue is zero ACEs, then the gray is one, the middle blue is two, the dark gray is three, and that lightish green is four more ACEs. So what this really shows is, you know, that impact of having that fourth ACE really does to a person's ability to be able to do activities of daily living. So 41% of people with four or more ACEs have difficulty remembering, concentrating, or making decisions, as opposed to 17% with no ACEs. And 37% of people with four or more ACEs are smokers, as compared with 20% with no ACEs. I don't have the data because I forgot to get it from our analyst, but it's coming. But the difficulty to do errands alone for those with four or more ACEs is much higher. What this suggests is, if you think about a parent or a single mom or any kind of caregiver that's working with a family, if they have a four or more ACE and they're having trouble remembering or making decisions or difficulty doing errands alone, how does that impact the family itself and the stability of that family?
Can I ask a question?
Oops, in kindergarten.
So the number four or more is obvious and makes sense, but why are 0, 1, 2, 3 on a declining graph? That doesn't make sense at all.
Right. Chair Lively, Representative Kenigari, that's one of the pieces that we're still trying to dive into, and that stood out to us, too. Mm-hmm.
Yes, Malmstrom.
Thank you. It seemed to me that when you look at that, there's four or more, so that could be 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So there's a lot of groups where the rest of them are just one or just two or just three.
Okay, so now we're back to the survey, National Survey of Children's Health. And this one is an interesting one. So it's parents who are being asked about their children. So the question itself says, does your child require, have a chronic condition requiring above routine health care? So that's how the question is asked. And when parents are asked that, whose child has 30, has two or more ACEs, have 31% more routine care, more hospital or clinic care, and a chronic condition that requires that than routine care. So again, it's just showing that impact on the healthcare system of ACEs. All right, now this is an interesting concept that is being developed called flourishing. And flourishing is one of those protective factors that helps build resiliency in children. So there are three components to flourishing. One is motivation. Does the child have curiosity and interested in learning new things? Two is resilience. Stays calm and in control when faced with a challenge. Doesn't flip the lid as much. Sorry, I'm using that because it's a fabulous thing to remember. And number three, attention. Follows through and finishes tasks. So children that have no ACEs clearly are a little bit more skilled in this, but the more ACEs you have, the less they're able to flourish. And so I think what this flourishing concept helps us do is to focus in on what are some of the concrete skills that we can help to build resilience in our children. And speaking of resilience, as was talked about before, it buffers the effects of trauma and adversity. Its relationships clearly at the center of it. In early childhood, this is where we look about successful and secure attachments and stable and responsive relationships. In later childhood and adolescence, it's moving to the peers, and can teenagers have good peer relations and relationships with other adults outside of the family? And in adulthood, are you able to have good have a social support, healthy relationships, and a connection to community, culture, and spirituality? So components can be for individuals. Do they have the capability for self-regulation, for self-efficacy and control, and the intellectual and emotional skills that are needed? Are they able to attach and bond and have strong relationships? And do they have that connection to their community? Communities also need to be resilient. So do they have equitable opportunities within that for all of its citizens? So living wages, quality education, local opportunities for economic development. Are they connected within each other, within the community to each other? Strong, healthy relationships and community norms, and I'm thinking of the 100% love. That's a really nice moniker for developing that. And then are their places safe and supportive, those environments? Do they have places where people can go and meet? Are there healthy foods, quality housing, and transportation? All right, so that's sort of the background. Now, in Oregon Health Authority, we're doing a lot of what has already been talked about. We have developed a Public Health Division Trauma-Informed Forum, in which we're trying to provide connectedness across our division and across the different programs to share information, do that workforce development, make recommendations to our leadership about how to increase the trauma-informed policies and procedures, and change the culture within public health so we can make it trauma-informed. As you saw on the ink blot, risk for HIV is highly attributable to having ACEs, and so they've been working, our HIV section's been working on this for a long time, and this is a big approach in their Ending HIV in Oregon plan. Our adolescent health program is working based on House Bill 4002, working with high schools to increase their trauma-informed education and training, and to change the culture within a couple of high schools at piloting. They're piloting in Central High School and Tigard High Schools, and have their school-based health centers that are participating in that. Our Women, Infant, and Children program is doing workforce training with all of their, out into their communities, with their coordinators and their partners. And as we've talked about in prior sessions, we've done a lot with our home visiting workforce. In the maternal and child health section itself, we have a large grant called the Title V Maternal and Child Health Block Grant. It's a federal grant out of HRSA. And in it, one of our 11 priorities is to address trauma and toxic stress. So we've been working a lot with our local public health and our tribes around these same kinds of interventions and starting to move the train down the track through training and home visiting, looking at the community itself. Is it a resilient community? How can we build resiliency? Partnerships with the hubs, with the CCOs, with the parenting hubs, and trying to build in the strength and protective factors for families. Oh, and there's that NEAR again, that neurobiology, epigenetics, ACEs, and resilience. Important foundational. At the state level, we are doing a lot to try to promote the training. We've brought the Infant Mental Health Endorsement Program to Oregon using our maternal, infant, and early childhood home visiting dollars. We've had our own training with Mandy. We're trying to increase the awareness and our own practices in our own house first and then move out. We also are trying to do things like promote racial equity within agency policies, promote the earned income tax credit and other family-friendly policies. And of course, one of our jobs in public health is to collect the data, so we do a lot of the assessment and evaluation work. In the CCO world, 10 of the 16 CCOs have specifically written ACEs in to their plans. You heard from one of them, Renee, I think in the Southern Oregon, has wrapped in the CCO in her region. And I won't go through all of these. There are variations on the same kinds of things, starting with the training, figuring out how we can connect and collaborate across the systems to create the community resiliency and prevention that we've already talked about. I'm going to turn it over to Lauren.
And once again, Chair Lively and Chair People, thank you for having us. Before I begin, I just wanted to ask if you got this handout. Did you get this handout? It was supposed to go along with your slides. Okay. So I want to start with the brain develops in response to experiences. The actual brain architecture, the neural network, is built on the experiences a baby and a young child has in the first 3 years. The brain grows to 90% of its adult size by age 3, so it's a wonderful opportunity to build the skills that the child will need for positive or negative expectations of the world. Is the world safe? Are people kind? The physiological stress responses. So how short is my fuse for having a tantrum? For does my cortisol and my stress hormones go out the roof over the least little thing, like I'm not getting what I want for lunch? And the ability to regulate one's emotions, regulate one's body and space. And emotion regulation has been shown by the kindergarten readiness assessments as being the key factor in school success. But they have to have it on day one of kindergarten. And we can help that, but it's much harder, it's much more difficult to change procedural memory and those physiological responses after age 3. And then the style of relating to others. Are we outgoing? Are we shy? Do we jump into an activity and interact with peers, etc.? So we can actually change the physical structure of the brain, positively or negatively. And one of the things you've been hearing is that as the adverse childhood experiences in a young child's life increase, things like neglect and abuse, but also things like car accidents, fires, being in the home of a parent with untreated substance abuse, multiple changes in foster placement, then the lifelong risk of serious and chronic physical ailments like heart disease, cancer, the suicide risk increase, but also learning problems, the ability to pay attention, to sit still in one's space, to keep one's hands off one's neighbor, to be able to transition from one activity to another are impacted by ACEs also. In Oregon in 2015, almost 5,452 children birth through 5 years old were victims of abuse or neglect and had founded reports. Of those 4,800 plus, almost 47 of them, of the maltreated children, were less than 6 years old. And that's a major type of adverse childhood experience, obviously, but not the only type. So it's very, very common. What we do matters. One of the misperceptions in the provider world is that children need to be talking, they need to be in school before they are treated for mental health disorders. And actually, there's quite a evidence base and worldwide knowledge about providing treatment early, down to infancy. But that requires mental health providers with very specialized training beyond their licensure for, as a mental health provider, and a deep understanding of human development and the ability to work with caregivers as well as with the children. That's a very special workforce, and we're fortunate in Oregon that we've had support from our leadership to build that workforce. But as most communities would tell you, they could use more. We need trauma-informed, evidence-based interventions that are age-appropriate. We cannot have a typical mental health professional providing typical mental health interventions with a 2-year-old or a 4-year-old. You're not going to get the effect. We have to understand the family in their cultural context, so socioeconomic as well as ethnicity and the level of violence in their community, et cetera. And we need to coordinate with primary care, early learning, child welfare, peer mentors, and other child caring agencies even more with early childhood than with older children. I mean, it's always great, but particularly when you're working with children who are not verbal yet, we need to be working on a team with this precious brain. And if we can do that, we can reduce lifelong suffering and medical costs. So we really need to start early with them. Luckily, we've had support for some evidence-based practices here for early childhood here in Oregon. This data is for parent-child interaction therapy, commonly known as PCIT, and it's only part of the data that we have for PCIT, but I thought that it clearly showed how incredibly effective it can be. This is the data for 2016 is currently being analyzed, and so that data will be out soon, but it's pretty consistent just at first glance with this. The Iberg Child Behavioral Inventory Intensity Score is what you're looking at. This is a standardized measure of common childhood behavioral issues that bring parents into agencies asking for help. And the normal range is 114 or below because, you know, children do things, they sass and they dawdle over dinner and stuff. So it's not zero, it's 114. Well, the families coming in have an average of childhood behavioral problems at 143.6 to 147.6, so way above the normal range. We're not talking about two-year-olds who are having a normal tantrum. We're talking about 2 to 7-year-olds who have been kicked out of multiple daycares and multiple preschools. And if you do an evaluation with them, most often you are finding that they have a history of adverse childhood experiences. The families that complete PCIT to the research criteria have those intensity problems decreased to well below the typically expected range. So those children are now regulated. They're being mainstreamed into kindergarten or Head Start classrooms. But the part that I really wanted you to hear about this that was most surprising to all of us in the PCIT world is that even those families who did not complete the program, who did not meet the research criteria for graduation, if they came 4 or more sessions to PCIT, they fell almost to the normal range, and that distance from 147.6 to 120.4 is statistically significant. Mm-hmm. So it's a major improvement. And the national research on PCIT shows that the results last. There are progressive studies that show 2 years and 6 years after ending treatment. And here in Oregon, you get these results in an average of 16 sessions. So we're not talking about years of work. Besides PCIT, we are working with the OHA Child and Family Behavioral Health team is working with the Children's System of Care Advisory Council, and their early childhood work group developed this handout that you have. And it's not meant to say that every community should look exactly like this, but what they were telling us at OHA is that there are large gaps in the continuum of care for early childhood to address ACEs and other problems that start on the lower ends with the social determinants of health, go up through policies and workforce development, then into early intervention and supports for nurturing relationships, and particularly there are still gaps in the higher levels of care for mental health services for our youngest and most vulnerable Oregonians, and that communities are now starting to use this diagram to sort of plug in, okay, what do we have in our community and where do we need to fill the gaps? We're also coordinating with Trauma-Informed Oregon and McVie, the Maternal Infant Child Home Visiting Programs, Relief Nurseries, Early Learning and Parenting Hubs. We provide supports and monitoring of the System of Care Wraparound Initiative, other evidence-based practices for early childhood like child-parent psychotherapy, which goes down to birth, and parent and family peer supports. We also have some workforce development projects going on, like we provide supports and scholarships to students who have master's degrees who are going through Portland State's graduate certificate program in infant toddler mental health. So first, they have their mental health degree, master's, and then it's an add-on level of expertise that we would like them to have. And we are working with the Oregon Infant Mental Health Association on encouraging clinicians to go through the core competencies and to become endorsed through there. And we frequently provide provider reimbursement guidance. There, like I said, there's a lot of misunderstandings in the provider world that mental health treatment isn't available to children under 5 or under 3, and I spend a lot of my time helping people understand how to do that correctly and effectively. And I'm going to turn it over to Kate if you don't have any questions at this time.
Thank you.
So just to wrap up, there are a few things that would help move these efforts along. Family-friendly policies that would reduce the stress and adversity for families, such as paid family leave, child care subsidies, affordable housing, earned income tax credit. Supporting trauma-informed workforces and workplaces and systems and services. Programs that strengthen the protective factors, both of the families, the individuals, as well as the communities. And then, of course, trauma-informed treatment, because you need the full spectrum of prevention, primary prevention, secondary prevention, and then treatment for those who have been
exposed
and who have had bad things happen to them. So that, I will open it up for questions.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I've listened to the three presentations, and I'm always trying to digest and always wondering if the lens from which we view our health care or our community advocacy is it Western? Is it Caucasian? Is it culturally based? And so I'm sitting here thinking that the number one trauma event that I would like to protect my children from is an adverse, and my husband for that matter, is being falsely accused of something and being stopped and frisked. And I would say perhaps that would translate also to people in the Muslim community. And so when I look at the adverse child experiences and the list of those, for me, the treatment of our community by the government is one of those things that ranks very high on the list for me. And so I know that that may never make it into how we look at data, but I can tell you that my children are not neglected. You know, we're not divorced. But one adverse interaction with the government is enough to take a child from here to here, and an adult as well. So I just wanted to offer that in somewhat of a moment of vulnerability, but to expand our lens and as to how we deliver health care to our citizens and how we form our values. So it is what it is.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to affirm what you said, and it's also not just about training, it's about policies that address those structural issues. Mm-hmm. Is race not one of those risk factors?
Chair Lively and Representative Kenny-Geyer, I'm going to actually turn that to Mandy, too. She's more in-depth with this than I am. But while she's coming up to maybe respond to that, I did also want to address your comments, Representative Bynum and Representative Kenny-Geyer. Racism and historical racism is one of those historical trauma pieces that's very much embedded in this. To that end, in the maternal and child health section, we actually started our work on focusing on health disparities, but looking at specifically racism. And then when we did our trauma training, we realized that those domains and that work is very interwoven. And so we've actually linked that up, and we are specifically looking at that within our own work. But in terms of the ACEs study, I'm going to turn it over to our expert.
Correct me if I don't get the formalities right. Representative Pimes, it's a great question. And Representative Kenny-Geyer, I don't know that I actually know enough about the ACE study, except that it's been repeated internationally. So what we need to do is get that, talk about that information, because the current ACE data, the original ACE study was done 17,000 folks who were white, San Diego, Kaiser Permanente, college educated, and over 50. But it has been replicated. So we need to pull that data. But I think, you know, we actually... there are folks in the field who are talking about, do we add things like experiencing racism as an intake question, right? So it's like child abuse, neglect, et cetera, and then experiencing marginalization or oppression. I mean, it's obviously bigger than just asking the question, because you have to know it's happened to you when it's so much part of our society. But that's why we are asking people, when they define trauma, to define it as also having experienced systemic oppression. Because the impact's the same on the body and the brain, and we've got to start having that conversation. So I do think it's interesting to think about how we have that conversation via policy. Like, how do we put that into that? This is, you may not have any of those 10 ACEs. And that's why the work out of California, those RISE work, was pretty impressive, because they were like, that's a piece that comes after having experienced these other social determinants of health. So I think we're slowly starting to have that conversation. But
thank you. Representative Malmstrom.
One piece of information to Representative Bynum's comment. Way back in the 1990s, before all the ACEs stuff came out, Multnomah County had a thing called the African American Birth Outcomes Project, and it was addressing exactly what you're talking about. And they found out that it was just like when you're counting ACEs and building up, every incidence of those racisms, you know, impacted the birth outcome. It's great data, and that was built, that data we took on to build other and form other projects. But there was some good data that related to that very point.
Thank you. I just want to continue. I think the way you have the conversation is really important, too, because if you say being black is a higher at-risk score and you leave it at that, that could leave up to interpretation, are black families more dysfunctional? The point is racism. The point is not the fault of the family, but what they get subjected to because of our structural systems, our cultural systems. Mm-hmm. So I've always heard of that as a really big risk factor, because when your husband, as you've said, goes out and has to worry about being snagged, whereas I don't have to worry about that with my husband, you're carrying a child. You carry that toxic stress when you worry about something that I'm not having to worry about. And so it's not the fault of, when you say, you know, communities of color are at higher risk, it's not the fault of communities of color. It's the fault of the structural problems we have in place. And I think we have been trying to address through several different policies, trying to chip away at that in our criminal justice system, in a whole variety of systems. We've been looking, in fact, we have several bills that have put a racial lens on some of the decisions that we make. So anyway, I think it's a really important stress factor to be considered.
And to the committee, I mean, the other thing I would say that I think is important is that when equity work is happening, there's some kind of momentum around equity and equity lens work, and it's defined differently in communities. That's why it's really important that I think you can do trauma-informed care and not attend to equity or not attend to issues of racism if we don't call those things out really clearly. Whereas you can, you know, it's hard to attend to working with marginalized populations or populations who've experienced systemic oppression without attending to trauma-informed care. So it's important that, because sometimes I heard recently somebody say something about, well, if you're trauma-informed, you're also addressing equity. And I was like, no. So we need to make sure those two things are happening at the same time. So it's important that in our work around training around trauma-informed care, so like one of our core components is you can't check the box of a trauma-informed 101 if you're not using the words around systemic oppression, racism, Islamophobia, you know, marginalized oppression, et cetera. So I think it's important to keep in that those training curriculum components we're going to put out there.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Anything else? Thank you all very much. Appreciate
it. Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Close the information.